You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming.
Now, coming up next, I'm going to be having a chat with two friends of mine, Matt and Tess, from the Sunday Paper. Hey guys, how you going?
Hey Kieran.
Hey Kieran, thanks for having us.
No worries, cheers for coming on. I wanted to get you on today to talk about a few things, to talk a bit about the Sunday Paper, why it exists, the sort of work that you do, as well as to give you a bit of free promo for the next edition that is coming out next month, I believe.
Indeed it is. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no worries. So I do have a bunch of questions to ask just to give the listeners a bit of a feel for what the Sunday Paper actually is. I should have told you this before, actually. Maybe before we do that, just for anyone who's never heard of the Sunday Paper before, how would you just briefly describe it?
I would say that the Sunday Paper is an anti-imperialist print periodical in the form of a tabloid newspaper that's very artfully produced by artists and designers and writers who care deeply about decolonial struggle, and that we aim to make something that can be read today or in 5 years and still be a meaningful read.
Yeah, I'd also say it comes in the form of a newspaper, but I think, you know, we think of it much more as an art project and also as a counter space, a demonstration, I guess, of the kind of counter spaces we need, particularly as, you know, even our most progressive, quote unquote, institutions often turn out to be rotten to the core. And, there's been a lot of conversation, particularly in the last years since Alexa Flood, about funding and who's involved in making the decisions within colonial organizations, institutions, funding bodies. And of course these things have always been a problem, but I think there's more of a spotlight on those problems now. And so the Sunday Paper, I think, is a demonstration of the kind of spaces that hopefully we'll see more and more of that exist outside of those systems of not only funding, but like systems of reward that a lot of other publications, creative spaces are kind of subservient to in this colony.
Yeah, definitely. It would be great to see a lot more of those sort of publications and organizations coming forward. I guess this is a great segue as well into my first question, which was, just kind of throw you all in the deep end with the questions here. But what sort of political and ethical commitments actually guide the Sunday Paper's editorial decisions? You've touched a bit on it, but I wonder if you could go into it a bit more.
Yeah. I think, like, before we talk about the Sunday Paper's editorial decisions, it's probably a good time to mention that you, Kieran, are our commissioning editor for the upcoming fourth edition. So this is something that I think, like, you and we can speak to. I think briefly, anti-imperialism and anti-colonial practice are, guide all our decisions.
Yeah, and also, I guess this isn't so much to do with morals, but our MO is also to publish the content that we see liberal publications censoring or drawing an editorial red line around. So we're seeking to publish beyond that liberal red line. So those communities and those voices and those politics that are quote unquote too much are for the Sunday Paper.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, I think also to say that like our political and or ethical mode of operation has changed. You know, so we began the project in 2021 during the Unity Intifada. And we began almost entirely, I guess, as a rebuke to Schwarz Media the Zionist-owned and you know, progressive posturing media organization, which at the time was, you know, fairly widely embraced by people on the so-called left. And so, yeah, I think the project began as a way of talking about Schwartz Media specifically and, you know, through that lens, talking more broadly about progressive coded organizations that, you know, are actually counter-revolutionary at best. So as the years have gone on, I think we've changed our focus a little bit. I think organizations like Schwartz, the problems with those organizations are more widely acknowledged now, particularly since October 7th. And so, yeah, I think we've broadened our mission statement, I guess, and also with the upcoming issue under your guidance, Kieran, as well, we've expanded into a much more, international perspective, encompassing, you know, struggles beyond, beyond this continent.
Just on that note as well, you know, how generally speaking do you decide which kind of struggles and movements and voices actually deserve sustained coverage? Because, you know, there's a lot of voices out there and a lot of struggles out there that, how do I put this nicely for the listeners? You know, there's a lot of struggles out there, for example, that would be counterintuitive to platform. A lot of voices that might be very counterintuitive to platform. You know, how do you make that tough decision about, you know, who you actually give coverage to?
Yeah, I think the Sunday paper is like kind of a corrective. You know, we try to fill the gaps and talk about the things that people aren't comfortable talking about or are not talking about in order to safeguard their careers or to build a career. And in 2021, like, you know, targeting Schwartz, we were specifically targeting an organization that is quote unquote progressive except Palestine, right? Mm. So I think we're looking for the gaps and we're looking to speak about speak about the things that we feel are being missed.
Yeah.
And I think a good example of that was Lorna Munro's piece about the referendum, because I feel like liberal media on this continent was centering and prioritizing yes voting mob and often silencing and shaming no voting mob. And it was really important to us that we made space for no voting mob on the paper, because so many other papers were kind of framing this quite large sector of the community in I guess less than respectful ways, would you say?
Yeah, and it was a really good piece, that one. A good addition overall as well.
Kieran, I wonder if we can throw that question back to you, seeing as you're the commissioning ed of this issue. How did you decide which struggles, movements and voices you wanted to focus on for issue 4?
It is a good question. I suppose for me, you know, I wanted to try and focus on the issues and struggles that most people on the so-called left here in Australia, you know, most people either are completely unaware of. So, you know, in terms of like a lot of the international struggles, you know, a lot of people don't understand what's happening on their own doorstep, you know, in places like Kanaki or, you know, New Caledonia, as it's now known, as an example. You know, a lot of people don't know what's happening today in Africa either. You know, they know a bit about the history. They might know about, you know, Thomas Sankara and, you know, the resistance to French imperialism and colonialism and stuff, but not many people could tell you what's happening on the African continent today. So I really wanted to try and focus on struggles that people might be less aware of. But also, another thing I really wanted to try and focus on, and maybe this is getting a little bit off topic or a little bit more onto a different question, about this next edition, but I really wanted to focus on the issues that I see in the so-called left today in Australia, you know, predominantly the issue of liberalism and the way that liberalism has really seeped into so many of our movements and, you know, so many of our communities and the way that we understand struggle and resistance. And yeah, I really wanted to try and give a voice to a, you know, counter-liberal sort of position for this edition.
Yeah, well this this edition obviously came out of conversations about liberalism, and they were also conversations with you, Kieran, and liberalism generally is something that that you and I have talked about too in the lead up. And yeah, we're calling this issue issue four is called The Pitfalls of Liberalism, in reference to the Kwame essay. And yeah, I think that's because we I think we're agreed that liberalism is an under-criticized but incredibly dangerous tendency on the so-called left at the moment. And I think increasingly on this continent, or at least it's sort of coming into sharper focus at the very least.
And it's, you know, just such a such an important time to really cover that as well. And because, you know, it's something that's just so present today everywhere we look. You know, it's in our community interactions, it's in the way that we interact with the land, it's in even in the way that we interact with ourselves on an interpersonal sort of level and stuff. And you know, it's something that I felt really needed to be combated, as Mao says, combat liberalism. Yeah. But yeah, it's something that really needed to, you know, the focus really needed to be drawn back onto it, in my opinion, because
it does. Yeah. It does. And because it's the water that we're all swimming in this particular colony especially, I think it's also something that it's really important that people don't get defensive and say, well, I'm not a liberal, because the reality is, like, we're all swimming in liberalism. Yeah. We're consuming it daily, passively, actively, through the Netflix shows we watch, through, you know, through anything that we engage with that is Western cultural production. It's highly likely that we're engaging in and even imbibing liberalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's less to do with saying I am not liberal and more to do with saying I am actively unlearning liberalism daily and taking some level of responsibility and accountability for your, I guess, liberalism cleansing.
Yeah, I think as you said in your editorial note for this issue, I might be paraphrasing you, but I think you said, you know, liberalism is the default ideology of our time or something to that effect, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that, yeah, that's definitely true for me. Like that's something that feels very true and it feels very dangerous. And I would definitely encourage anyone who hasn't read that original essay, The Pitfalls of Liberalism, it's a 1969 essay, to do so. That would be great kind of background reading for the Sunday paper.
And great background reading for the years to come.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's not just, it really highlights how much of an issue this is still today. The fact that, you know, Kwame Ture wrote that essay nearly 60 years ago now. And, you know, around the same time or even earlier than that, you know, you had even people like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King even, who, you know, quite often is seen as a bit of a liberal himself, speaking out against liberalism and, you know, speaking out against the pitfalls and the drawbacks of it and the traps of it and, you know, the way that it seeps into movements and infects them. And
it's horrifying in a way too, but also quite fascinating how relevant those texts are. As you say, they're quite old texts now, but honestly, you read these words and they could be speaking directly to the quote-unquote left in the Australian colony in 2026. Like, you have to do very little sort of transposing. They're like direct rebukes of exactly what we're seeing. The diluting we're seeing on the left.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's to go back to the question, you know, that's why I felt like it was such an important topic that, you know, really needed to be addressed ASAP, and you know, Sunday paper was a perfect platform to try and address that, being, you know, independent media that provides an actual radical and revolutionary space for the voices that are quite often cut out of the other so-called progressive media spaces. On that note,
going through that process with you, Kieran, and I think we had, from memory, we had a few topics that we were throwing around as possible themes for this issue, and we all agreed that this is like the essential and urgent conversation.
Just on that as well, like, you know, the Sunday paper is independent media, but, you know, what does independent media actually, like, mean in practice for you, you know, generally speaking, not just about this edition, but about the previous editions and stuff as well, and just the entire project that is the Sunday paper?
Yeah, that's a really good question, I think, because often when we hear things described as independent, they're far from independent. Like, they're beholden to funding bodies, or they're aligned with colonial institutions and organizations, or with, you know, systems of reward. And independence for us, like, literally does mean independent. Like, we have no relationships with institutions. We accept no corporate funding or state funding. So we're 100% funded by our listeners and readers. And what that means is that we make an issue when we have enough to fund an issue. and how substantial that issue can be is also determined by the support that we get. So there's actually a direct relationship there between the people who love and read and listen to our content and the ways in which we continue to produce it, or even actually whether we're able to.
Did you want to add something, Tess? Or?
I'm just thinking about that question again. There was something that occurred to me. I'm just going to mull it over. No, I think Matt's covered it really well.
I think, like, being independent for us is more than, you know, is where we get our funding or who's supporting us. It's actually an ideological position. So we also don't care.
Principle-based.
That's what I was thinking
okay, about.
Take it away.
That's exactly right. No, we don't care. And, like, the thing is, because we're using our principles to guide what and when and how we publish, we're making, like, the litmus test for what we make and when we make it is very different. The idea of being independent there has to do with platform, like, choosing to prioritize land back over career, for instance.
Yeah.
So we're not going to make a publication just because we think that the readership's going to love that publication. We're making it because we think it genuinely may be beneficial to our cause.
Yeah.
And that often leads us to be publishing things that will actually be challenging for readers, may upset people and may lead us into trouble, let's say. But we're certainly not, we're not making decisions for the Sunday paper based on any capitalist metrics.
On that note as well, you know, how, you know, who do you see yourself as being, like, actually accountable to? You know, would it be, like, the readers? Would it be movements? Would it be funders? You know, something else?
I think, picking up on what Tess was just saying, it's about ideology. I think we're accountable to our principles, and we're accountable to ideology. And I think often when people in the Australian colony talk about their politics, they're often not actually talking about their principles. They're talking about, you know, what social groups they're aligned with, or what, you know, what popular figures they're aligned with. And even movements, we know, can change. They can be infiltrated. They can be subsumed by liberalism. I don't think we're accountable to our readers necessarily, or movements necessarily. although we obviously are accountable to many of them. And, you know, the overarching thing to mention too, I guess, is that we're obviously accountable to Indigenous people, you know, on this continent and beyond, and to land back. But yeah, I think we always come back to our principles rather than, you know, the readership.
Yeah, or,
social groups that we might feel beholden to.
For example, we're accountable to you, obviously, Kieran, and that's because we're in genuine community with you. We're very much accountable to the people who we're in genuine daily community with. And I think that sort of ties into the way liberalism can kind of thrive on us always being online and never working offline. Many of the people we're accountable to are the people who we organise and work with outside of the online space. So, for example, the people who we connect with at Camp Sovereignty, or the people who we connect with through our art practices, are the people who we build greater degrees of trust and meaningful connection with. These are the kinds of people who you become very meaningfully accountable to. And they're the people who you go through processes of rupture and repair with, because that's substantial and genuine community building.
Yeah. And, you know, just to add on to that as well, like, you know, a bit of a different topic. Maybe this is a topic of liberalism that we potentially could have covered, but we didn't, unfortunately. But the whole notion of, you know, people seeing rupture as, you know, abuse and stuff, and not as an opportunity for repair and, you know, for actually building community and, you know, building those differences, opinions, and understanding each other better, and, you know, having that repair, which can often make relationships stronger than before the rupture even existed. Yeah, I just wanted to state that.
Yeah, absolutely. and that kind of that feeds into, I guess, one of the tactics, or like pitfalls, of liberalism, is, you know, you'll often hear a liberal say that what needs to be prioritized is cohesion or strategy, you know, not rocking the boat, keeping things, you know, respectable, so that we can build a broader movement, is often the reason for that that's presented. You know, and I would argue that rather than building a broad movement, the focus on respectability and avoiding conflict actually leads to a rightward drift. Because often the people that we're accommodating through being respectful, through avoiding conflict, are the people to our right. And it's actually not the people who are genuinely revolutionary who are accommodated by that focus on respectability.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it's often pitched as harm reduction. But once you subsume those people into your movements, if there isn't genuine trust, if there isn't genuine respect, then it can lead to a much wider sweeping harm.
Yeah.
100%. The thing we often hear in this colony that's become a bit of a meme, but, you know, the left is eating itself, is often presented as something that we need to avoid. And it's often presented to people who are criticizing liberal tendencies on the left.
Yeah. I've got a lot of, We could talk about this for like a whole show in itself, but yeah, a lot of criticisms of these things on the left, and, you know, the whole framing of stuff like leftist infighting and whatever else, that whole big tent unity, and how it actually serves to further undermine and de-radicalize spaces. But we're not talking about that today. That's, as I said, that's a whole episode in itself. But talking about like rupture and repair and stuff, though, I'm just wondering, you know, do you ever get much criticism from the community that you report on? And if so, like, how do you actually handle that kind of criticism?
I think the first thing to say about like criticism on the left, like within the left, is unfortunately the criticism often happens behind one's back.
Yes.
but in as much as we do get criticism, I think like consultation is really important, and it's always better to be deeply engaged and consultative from the outset, obviously, rather than you know, do that consultation as part of your process of like response or repair to criticism, right? And yeah, I think the Sunday paper focuses on consultation and relationships from the outset. So like when those disagreements perhaps or criticisms do come, they're often coming in the context of an existing relationship and a shared goal.
Yeah.
Consulting before publishing. So some kind of prevention and risk mitigation around harm doing is really important to us. And most of the work that, even independently of the Sunday paper that Matt writes, he will write in consultation with between, you know, 3 and 10 other members of his extended communities. And I think that kind of preparatory and, I guess, consultative labor ensures that by the time you publish, the criticisms you get, you've kind of talked through with your extended community and you have some context for already.
Yeah.
And then I suppose if you do, say you do end up doing harm and you, or there's just general political disagreement and criticism, then in-person conversation or face-to-face conversation is prioritized always.
Yeah. Something that's definitely missing with this whole online world that we live in today.
100%.
Yeah. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show. You're listening to Yellowman on 3CR, 855 AM, your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online via the playback service. And I'm having a yarn with two of my mates, Tess and Matt from the Sunday paper. Because we only have about 10 minutes left, there's a couple of questions in particular that I wanted to try and cover where we've got the time. But one of them is, you know, what... how do you work with like the emerging writers and organizers? Because, you know, no doubt there's probably a lot of people out there that are listening that, you know, themselves might, you know, want to one day pitch to the Sunday paper or, you know, a similar publication or, you know, make their own publication and stuff like that. What sort of, you know, what sort of, how do you work with those sort of people? Yeah.
Yeah, well, lots of people have really important things to say and haven't had any experience being published, and that's partly an indictment on the colonial framework that we're constantly having to operate within, that they haven't had an opportunity to have their work platformed, and we really want to make space for them. Many of those people don't even have experience writing independently of the media, and there were a few examples of that over the past two issues. And one of the ways that I really love resolving that is actually through a cup of tea over Zoom, and pre-arranged recording of that cup of tea over Zoom and then transcribing what the writer has said and then sharing that in a document that we workshop together until everyone's really happy with it. And I think that content that is created in this way is like super meaningful and super engaging because it has obviously a conversational tone, but it also allows the author to relax, ease up and say what they really mean, because conversation is something that everyone that we're working with has experience in. So one thing.
Yeah, so the way that we have worked until now hasn't been, like, we haven't been accepting pictures. I mean, we've received pictures, but that's not, that hasn't been our approach. So we start with the theme of an issue and we talk about the breadth of that theme and what we need to, what we feel needs to be said about it. And then we talk about who the best person might be to write or create art on that theme. And with the last two issues, issue 3 and issue 4, the one that you've been helping with us in, Kieran, we've had a commissioning editor. And so we've allowed decisions about who to reach out to and who to include or begin conversations with to ultimately be the decision of the commissioning editor. Having said that, it's an ever-evolving art project that may function differently in future. And also, we always welcome people reaching out with ideas.
And I think also for people to know that the accessibility framework that we're operating within also encompasses an understanding that, for example, someone who's in the stages of early motherhood and having, or parenthood and having to tend to a little baby may not have time to write, and it may be easier to get them on the phone or get them to record their voice and then we transcribe that and work with them on it. There's like, we're so willing to find a way to ensure that valuable, important, considered voices find themselves in the paper.
Yeah, no, it's a really good idea too, that whole, you know, just phone call and transcribing and stuff like that, and really accommodating, that's the word I'm looking for. But it's good because, you know, it means that you can get those voices that, you know, otherwise might not be able to be heard.
That's right.
Yeah. One of the other bigger questions I wanted to ask is, you know, where to from here sort of thing? Like, where do you want the publication to be in 5 years' time, for example?
I would love the publication to continue and grow. And the Sunday Paper podcast is also a platform that we're working on and that we hope will grow. And the podcast is something that occurs in between issues. Sometimes issues can come out a year apart. So it's definitely not something that comes out regularly, and each issue, you know, really takes the kind of work you would put into a book with multiple authors. You know, we spend a lot of time on it. We think really carefully about the artworks. It's not a project we're churning out, even though it does come in the form of a tabloid newspaper. So I would hope that it keeps receiving the support of our community of readers and listeners, and that we can, we can perhaps change the format, perhaps be more playful with content, you know, bring the paper out in different forms. But I also, like, more broadly, obviously the Sunday paper is never going to be the only counter space that we need.
Yeah.
And I really do see it as a model. Here's what you can do. And it is possible to do it. Maybe it's harder, but it is possible to do it outside of the framework of institutional funding and, you know, all the systems that compromise us when we're making something like this. So I would hope that, not only does the Sunday paper grow, but also a lot of other similar, genuinely independent and genuinely revolutionary publications, platforms, audio content, these kinds of things, that they do multiply, and there are many more of them available.
And the more that become available, the easier it becomes for all of us, because then we have collective power and we can work alongside each other and with each other. We can collectivize distribution channels. We can provide each other editorial support. There are so many possibilities that currently aren't available to publications like the Sunday paper in any significant way that could very easily become available to us if there were just a handful more publications, publishing houses, platforms that have similar values and are doing similar work. And we're very much available for answering the questions of and talking with people who are interested in creating new counter spaces.
Yeah, nice. That's good to hear, I suppose. And it's a really good note to finish on. We've got about 2 minutes or a minute and a half or so left on the show. Anything else you just wanted to quickly plug or talk about? Where can people go on order, for example?
Well, first of all, because we're reader supported, if you want to see more Sunday papers, you just have to buy the Sunday paper now so that you get the next one. So I would just say that genuinely, the more you support the paper materially, the more editions of the paper you will get. So that's one thing. And also it's very affordable. It's only $12 and you can get it from slingshotbooks.com.au/the-sunday-paper.
Yeah, nice. All righty. Well, thanks for coming on the show. It's been a great yarn to have. Fortunately, we have run out of time, but it'd be good to get you back on in the next couple of weeks. There's still plenty
thanks
of
so much,
questions and stuff I wanted to grill you about, but yeah, run out of time today. But, cheers for coming on, and I'll talk, catch up with you again soon.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having us.
No worries. See you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.